long since I've been back, just a few weeks, but it seems like there's already all these changes that are taking place. We got songs on the PowerPoint, and Doug's making arguments for rap music, worship service in the songs. So I'm looking forward to coming back and seeing how Jeremy leads us in those rap spoken verses next time, see what other things will be changing. But good to be here with you this morning. Mark chapter 8, we're going to look here at this phrase, this question, actually, that Jesus asked Peter. Who do you say that I am? You notice in verses 27 and 28, Jesus has been talking with his disciples, and he's been saying, who do people say that I am? And of course, there's all sorts of answers that the people have been giving. You know, there's all sorts of ideas floating around. Who is Jesus? And the disciples say, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, others one of the prophets. Who is Jesus? That's the question on everybody's minds there in Israel in the first century. Who is this man? And yet Jesus turns to Peter and he says, well, you know, I'm not really interested in what they are saying about me. I'm interested in what you are saying about me, Peter. I want to know, who do you say that I am? And I want to suggest to you that, you know, of course, there are many ideas even today about who Jesus is. There are many different answers that people give to this question of who is Jesus. Jesus is to some a failed revolutionary. Others, you know, a kind of a new age moral teacher. To some throughout history, he's been kind of a hippie communist who's inspired different movements along those lines. In fact, Jesus has been invoked to justify everything from wars to racism to you name it. People have looked to Jesus to justify all sorts of things. That's because when we look to Jesus and try to answer that question, we tend to see what we want to see when we look at Jesus instead of letting Jesus define who he is. And that's a problem because our response to Jesus is going to be determined by who we think he is, who we understand him to be. And so what I want to do this morning, this verse, by the way, Mark chapter 8 and verse 29, this whole scene is really the centerpiece of Mark's gospel. It's really the apex almost of what he's been trying to say. And so I want to work back to it in a little bit of an unorthodox way. I want us to go through the Gospel of Mark together, or at least the first half of the Gospel of Mark, to answer this question, who is Jesus? I want to begin where Mark begins, in Mark chapter 1 and verse 1, with the very first statement of the Gospel. Mark says, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. There you go. Mark gives the ending away from the very beginning. Spoiler alert, right? You want to know who Jesus is? Jesus is the Son of God. Mark tells you in the very first verse. But there's a certain dramatic irony to this because readers know from the very first verse who Jesus is and the confession that we are supposed to be making about Jesus. But the characters in the story are really clueless as to who Jesus is, except the demons, interestingly enough. Jesus will cast out demons. He will work miracles, and the demons will fall before him and say, you are the Son of God. Leave us, you Son of God. But the human characters have no idea. They don't make this confession that Jesus is the Son of God. In fact, they don't even make this confession even though a voice from heaven, the Father is speaking from heaven and saying, this is my Son. And Mark chapter 1 and verse 11, a voice comes out of the heavens. This is at Jesus' baptism when he's been baptized in a crowd and other people are watching him. And the voice comes from heaven and says, you are my beloved Son, in you I am well pleased. The Father is going to do this again in Mark chapter 9 and in verse 7 when Peter and John are on the Mount of Transfiguration and Jesus is somewhat figured before them, a very interesting story in many ways. And what's also interesting is that Elijah and Moses appear with Jesus, and they're talking with Jesus. Very strange story, very mysterious kind of story. And Peter's reaction is, okay, the three great prophets of Israel are here, right? Moses and Elijah and Jesus. And let's make three tabernacles, and let's kind of honor these three prophets of Israel. And then verse 7 of Mark chapter 9 says, a cloud forms overshadowing them, and a voice came out of the cloud. This is my beloved Son. Listen to Him. Right? Nobody's listening to the voice from the heaven, and nobody's listening to the Son of God. Nobody's listening, really, to Jesus. In fact, it's not until the very end of the gospel and some of the very last verses of the gospel where a human character finally confesses that Jesus is the Son of God. Do you know where that is? It's at the foot of the cross. In Mark chapter 15 verse 39, someone speaks out and says, truly this man was the Son of God. And those words are on the lips of a Gentile, an unbeliever, a centurion, a Roman centurion who helped to put Jesus to death. He sees him take his last breath and he looks up at his Savior and he says, truly this was the Son of God. What is Mark telling us? Mark's telling us that Jesus is the Son of God. And what that means is that we can only understand Jesus as the Son of God if we look to the cross. Because the Son of God came to be a servant. He came to die for you and I. That's the message that we're supposed to take away from Mark's gospel. So why is it that nobody in Mark's gospel seems to get that message until the centurion? Why do people misunderstand Jesus in the gospel? Why do people misunderstand Jesus today? Why is he the spokesman for all different sorts of diverse groups and agendas? Why do people misunderstand Jesus? That's the question that I really want to come back to. But first I want to look at the disciples, because I think the clue to answering this question is by following the disciples through Jesus' ministry here. What's funny about Jesus in this gospel is Jesus is going around and he's doing all sorts of miracles and he's healing and he's doing all sorts of wonderful things, many great teachings, and the disciples are misunderstanding him at every turn. So let me give you some examples of this. In Mark chapter 4 and verse 11, Jesus says to his disciples, those who have been following him around, when he's alone with them, the 12 men, he says to them, to you it has been given the mystery of the kingdom of God, but to those who are outside, they get everything in parables. Jesus says to them, you have been given a special place. You have been given the secret. The mystery has been revealed to you. Those who are outside aren't getting that, and that's why they're getting the parables. And he says, that I give them the parables so that while seeing they may see and not perceive, and while hearing they may hear and not understand. Otherwise they might return and be forgiven. And he said to them, do you not understand this parable? How will you understand all the parables? Jesus is saying to them, you've been given the revelation, right? So you ought to be able to understand the parables that is confusing everybody over here. But then he looks to the disciples and he can tell, you're not even understanding what I'm saying here, are you? You're not getting the message. And this is only going to continue later on in Mark's gospel, in Mark chapter 7 and in verse 17 through 18. They're going to misunderstand the parables again. Mark 7 and verse 17, when he had left the crowd and entered the house, his disciples questioned him about the parable. And he said to them, are you so lacking in understanding also? You know, Jesus can be pretty harsh with his disciples sometimes. But he's never harsher with anybody than with his disciples. And he's harshest with them at their lack of understanding. He expects them to understand what he's doing and what he's all about. But they keep misunderstanding things. Not only do they keep misunderstanding things, but because of their misunderstanding, their lack of faith is a recurring problem for the disciples. So, for example, in Mark chapter 4, when Jesus is out on the sea with his disciples, they're in the boat and a great storm appears on the sea. And we know something about great storms, don't we? We know how terrifying they can be. I know, as was made in the announcements, we're thinking and praying for loved ones in Florida because we know how devastating that is. And yet, Jesus seems to think that they shouldn't be scared of this. And yet they are. He says to them in verse 40, "Why are you afraid? Do you still have no faith?" The disciples don't have the faith that Jesus thinks they ought to, and he's exasperated at them. A couple more examples. In Mark chapter 6, and in verses 51 through 52, this is another occasion when Jesus is out on the sea, but this time he's not in the boat, he's walking out on the water. And he walks out on the water. And then he gets back in the boat with them, and the wind stops, and they were utterly astonished. And the text tells us, verse 52, they had not gained any insight from the incident of the loaves, but their heart was hardened. You see, they're not paying attention to what Jesus is doing. They're misunderstanding what he's saying. They're misunderstanding what he's about. And as a result, their faith is weak, and their hearts are hardened. Right? In Mark chapter 8, we're almost back to this scene that we began with Jesus and Peter. But a couple more things I want to say real quick. In Mark chapter 8, Jesus is has gathered a large crowd around him. And the people have left their homes to come out and hear Jesus, and Jesus feels compassion upon them, and he wants to be able to feed them, right? And he's done this already, by the way. He's already fed a multitude of people. But the disciples are worried about where the food's going to come from. Mark chapter 8 and verse 4, the disciples answer, "Where will anyone be able to find enough bread here in this desolate place to satisfy these many people?" I don't know. There's not a Walmart near around. There's not an HEB. Where are we going to get bread? Maybe the guy who just fed a multitude, can do that again, right? Maybe we could find him again. Two more examples of the disciples' misunderstanding. They get back in the boat, and they don't have any bread with them, all right? They didn't take anything with them for their journey. And Jesus, he's just had this encounter with the Pharisees. And you know the Pharisees, they're this group of religious leaders in Israel that everybody looked up to, everybody admired, and Jesus said they were, they were wrong. They were leading the people astray. And so when he's in the boat with his disciples and he's speaking with them privately, he says to them in Mark chapter 8 and verse, and he says, "Watch out for the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod." And what's the disciples' response in verse 16? They began to discuss with one another the fact that they had no bread. See, Jesus is talking about bread being leavened. He's saying, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, beware of the leaven of Herod. And the disciples say, "Oh yeah, you know what? We didn't bring any bread." They completely miss the point. And I just dropped my notes. But they completely miss the point of what Jesus is trying to say. And he rebukes them for it. In verse 17, Jesus, aware of this, said to them, "Why do you discuss the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet see or understand? Do you have a hardened heart?" It's hard for me to imagine that the disciples have no knowledge of who Jesus is, that they don't have some convictions about this man that they've been traveling around with and listening to him teach and explain the scriptures and healing people and casting out demons and causing the winds and the waves to still and raising people from the dead. Jesus has been doing some remarkable things in their presence. So, and they've left their homes to follow him. So there's some knowledge of who Jesus is, but Jesus says you're still not getting it. And so Jesus decides to give them a lesson. Because as he says here, look at verse 8, he says, "Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear?" He says, you're seeing what I'm doing, but you're not really getting it. You're not really perceiving it. And so let me give you an example to do this. And this leads to one of my favorite episodes in the whole gospel. In verse 22 of Mark chapter 8, Jesus and the disciples go to a town called Bethsaida. And the people there know Jesus' reputation. They know that he's a man who heals people. He's got power, the power of God behind him. And so what do? They bring him a blind man to be healed by Jesus. And Jesus takes the blind man by the hand, and he does something a little weird this time. He spits on his hands, right? And then he rubs the eyes of the blind man. And he says to the blind man, "Do you see anything?" Look at the blind man's response in verse 24. He said, "I see men, for I see them, but they're like trees walking around." And so then Jesus again takes his hands and lays them on his eyes, and he looked intently and was restored, and he began to see everything clearly. Now, this was a story that always kind of puzzled me when I was a kid. I was like, you know, what's going on? Did Jesus, you know, was his power not working very well? You know, he goes to heal him initially, rubs his eyes initially, and the healing's kind of fuzzy a little bit. I mean, he could see a little bit, but it's not completely clear, and so he has to kind of, you know, recharge his power or something and then rub his eyes in so he can see, right? But that's not the point at all. The point is Jesus is, he's telling his disciples that you're like this blind man. You're seeing kind of fuzzy. You're seeing things fuzzy, right? You're kind of halfway there. You understand who I am, you know, sort of, but you don't see things clearly. And so I'm about to make it clear to you. And that brings us back finally to this episode that we began with in Mark chapter 8 and verse 29, when Jesus is asking Peter, "Who do you say that I am?" Everyone in here could tell me Peter's response. Peter looks to him and he says, "You are the Christ." And most of us read that and we say, "Well, good job, Peter. You got the answer right." But it's clear in, you know, if we're reading in context, if we're reading Mark's gospel the way he's intending us to read it, Peter doesn't give the right answer. Not exactly. I mean, don't get me wrong. It is true that Jesus is the Christ and all that that means. Christ was the anointed one, the Messiah, the King of Israel that was to return for his people. But that's all that Peter really understood about who the Christ was supposed to be or the Messiah, right? We hear Christ and we think, well, yeah, the divine Son of God who came from heaven and atoned for our sins, right? But that's not the way Peter heard that, right? Christ was a term for the promised king who was going to come and make Israel great again. And that was an accident, but this was the political expectation of Israel, right? And so Who did Peter expect the Messiah to be, the Christ to be, the King to be? Well, someone who's going to lead an army and liberate Israel from Rome. And so when Peter says, I believe you're that guy. You're the Christ. You're the one who's coming to liberate us. But Jesus says, yeah, but that's not exactly what I came to do. I am that guy, but I'm not coming in the way that you expect. And so Jesus is going to tell him for the first time in the whole gospel, he's really frank with his, and he tells them absolutely what he came here for. Look at verse 31. He began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and 3 days later rise again. And verse 32 says, and he was stating the matter plainly. It's the first time Jesus has done this. He's been speaking in parables. He's been hinting at it. You know, he's been drawing applications from Scripture, and he's been kind of leading his disciples there, but he hasn't stated the matter plainly until just now. He says, this is the reason I came. I came to be rejected and to die. And what's Peter's response? Peter rebukes him. Can you imagine the temerity of Peter to say, no, you didn't come here for that, and no, that is absolutely not what's going to happen. You are not going to go and be rejected and die. You're out of your mind, Jesus. That's what Peter said. Jesus turns to him and rebukes him, and he says, get behind me, Satan, for you're not setting your mind on God's interests, but on man's. You see, this is who Jesus is. He's a crucified Messiah. He's someone who came to be the Son of God and to demonstrate that most powerfully on the cross. But that's not what Peter wanted. That's not what Peter expected. And this, I submit, is why Peter and the rest of the disciples misunderstand who Jesus was. They don't want this to be their Messiah. They were expecting something different. They were wanting something different. They were wanting to follow Jesus and be part of a glorious revolution. And it was a revolution that Jesus was inaugurating. It was something much different. It was something where the leader goes to die and where he calls his followers to take up their cross and follow him as well. 3 points of application I want to make from this, and I want to take it from the text, because there's 3 times, actually, when Jesus is going to tell his disciples that he's going to the cross. He tells Peter here, and you'd think that Peter would get it after that, but then he has to tell his disciples again. And then he has to tell them again. And each time they misunderstand, and Jesus has to correct them. So I want to look at those three episodes really quickly, and I want to draw a point of application from each. First, this first scene. Why is it that Peter is misunderstanding Jesus here? I submit it's because he knows if the leader of this movement, Jesus, is going to be rejected and killed, things don't bode very well for him. And Jesus makes that pretty plain in the next verses. In verse 34, he summons the crowd with his disciples, and he says to them, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, and he must take up his cross and follow. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what will a man give in exchange for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of him when he comes in the glory of his Father and with the holy angels. What's Jesus saying here? He's saying, don't be ashamed of me. And that's the first takeaway I'd have us leave here with. Don't be ashamed of who Jesus is. Jesus says, if you want to save your life, you're going to lose it. What does he mean by that? Well, I understand Jesus to be talking about what we might say in our day, I want to be somebody. Right? That's what he means by saving his life, right? We want to be somebody whom people admire, people look up to and respect. We place our self-worth in all these things, admiration from others, wealth, good looks, intelligence, our families, our material possessions, right? All of these things are kind of define who we are to some degree. And we'd hate to have to leave those things behind. And we'd hate to have to follow someone whose whole mission was just self-sacrifice. You know, it's a little bit comfortable to be, I mean, maybe less so today, but it's still more comfortable to be a Christian in America in the 21st century than it was to be a Christian in Israel or anywhere in the Roman Empire in the first century. Right? America's kind of unique in that, Christianity's been a part of our history from the very beginning, and, you know, at least nominally, most people in America profess, if not a regular church attendance, or they at least profess some sort of admiration for Jesus and his teachings, right? Wouldn't you agree? But it wasn't like that in the first century. I mean, think about what you're telling people to do. Hey, I want you to be a part of this movement. Our leader's a guy who was stripped naked and hung on a cross like a common criminal. And he was a poor man. He never really owned anything. And people mocked him and made fun of him. And he was rejected by his own people. And that's our leader. You want to be in my club, you know? You want to follow us? You want to come to our church service? It was pretty embarrassing to be a Christian. For many years, I mean, you read the early histories of the church, and people made fun of Christians. Like, what? Who do these people think they are? They're weird, and they're lost in society, right? The people that fill their church buildings are poor people, right? And they're ignorant people. They're not philosophers. They're not nobility. They're just regular people. It was embarrassing to be a Christian. And maybe we're not embarrassed to be Christians so much today because we've adapted so much of that worldly culture, that worldly influence into how we do Christianity, right? Not too many people in America have to get rid of their material possessions to follow Christ, right? Or have to give up that dream of rising to the top of, their company or whatever, to be a Christian. I mean, nobody's going to look funny at you if you buy a new house. Nobody's going to say, you're a little bit materialistic, right? Maybe, I don't know, maybe that's a problem with us. We've adapted so much of our kind of materialistic, me-first culture into how we follow Christ. It was an embarrassing thing to follow Christ in the first century. And Jesus says, don't be ashamed of who I am. Don't seek after the idols of this world. Seek after the pattern that I'm showing you. Don't be ashamed of who I am. Well, there's a second time where Jesus is going to reveal himself pretty clearly, pretty plainly to his disciples. It's in the very next chapter, Mark chapter 9 and verse 31. Jesus tells his disciples, again, pretty plainly, the Son of Man is to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he has been killed, he will rise 3 days later. Well, what do you know? The very next verse, verse 32, we're told they did not understand this statement, and they were afraid to ask him. And they came to Capernaum. And when he was in the house, he began to question them, "What were you discussing on the way?" But they kept silent, for on the way they had discussed with one another which of them was the greatest. Jesus says, "I'm going to die, guys. I'm going to make myself last." And they're debating about, you know, is it Peter that's the most righteous of us? Is it John? Is it Thaddeus? But who's the best among us? That's what they're talking about. And so Jesus has to correct the understanding yet again. In verse 35, this is how he does it. He sits down with them in verse 35 and says, "If anyone wants to be first, he shall be last of all and be a servant of all." And then taking a child, he set him before them, and taking him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever receives one child like this in my name receives me. And whoever receives me does not receive me, but him who sent me." So Jesus says to his disciples, look, you want to follow after me? You want to be my disciple? Make yourself a servant. Put yourself last. And then he does this object lesson where he takes a kid into his arms and loves this kid and welcomes this kid. And maybe that's a little bit lost on us in our culture too, because we love kids, right? We kind of cater to kids in our culture, but in there, it's kind of hard for us to understand. The first century, kids were a nuisance, you know. When you're working all day, every day, out in the field, you know, and you've got a little baby that can't lift anything, that's kind of annoying, you know. They didn't really have this gushy attitude towards kids in the ancient world. In fact, children were abandoned oftentimes in the ancient world. They were unwanted. They were unprotected. They were certainly unloved. And so that's why Jesus takes this child to himself and he says, look, love those whom society doesn't love. Love the weak. Love those that can't do anything for you. Right? And that's the attitude, I think, that we ought to have as well, is we ought to make ourselves a servant, especially to those who are weak and defenseless, and those who can't pay us back in return. That's the true measure of a disciple. It's easy to go and help someone who you love and admire, who you know you're going to get some return. It's hard to go and work for someone who not going to thank you, maybe might even mock you and ridicule you and treat you poorly, even though you're helping them. But that's the kind of attitude that we have to have. We have to make ourselves a servant. And then finally, the final scene is in the next chapter, in Mark chapter 10 and verse 32. They're on the road to Jerusalem, and what that means, that's shorthand for he's going to die, right? Where does he die? He dies in Jerusalem on a cross. And so they're going towards Jerusalem. Jesus, he has his mind set. He's going to fulfill his mission. And Jesus is walking on ahead of them. And they were amazed. And those who followed were fearful. And again, he took the 12 aside and began to tell them what was going to happen to them. All right, third time he's going to tell them. He says, "Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death, and they will hand him over to the Gentiles. They will mock him, and they will spit on him, and they will scourge him, and they will kill him. And 3 days later, he will rise again." Well, what's the very next thing we're told? Verse 35, James and John, the two sons of Zebedee, came up to Jesus saying, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." And Jesus says, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Grant that we may sit one on your right and one on your left in your glory." It's funny, isn't it? It's meant to be funny. From our vantage point, we know who Jesus is. He's this crucified Messiah, and he keeps telling his disciples this. And they're arguing about who's going to have the better place in his kingdom. They still think it's some kind of triumphant worldly kingdom, but that's not Jesus' plan at all. And so Jesus is going to correct their understanding one more time. If you go down to verse 42, "Calling them to himself, Jesus said to them, 'You know that those who are recognized as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. But it is not this way among you, but whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. And whoever wishes to be first among you shall be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." So first Jesus says, don't be ashamed of who I am. Next he says, make yourself a servant. And finally he says, redefine your notion of success. We think in terms of who's going to be first, who's going to be paid more, who's going to come out on top, right? Who's going to be holding that trophy at the end? That's how we measure success. Jesus says, no. That's how the Gentiles do, right? They're wanting to know about who's going to have the best place, who's going to have the best seat. And they're interested in having that best seat so they can lord it over everybody else and they can wield their power like a sword. Jesus says that's not the way to success. The way that Jesus accomplished our atonement was he said to, you know, to Satan and all the sinful forces of this world, he said, "Give me your best shot, and I'll take it." He surrendered to them, and through his surrender, he brought about their defeat. And that ought to be how we measure success in our own lives, is to the standard of Jesus. Well, when we think about Jesus, we understand that people look at Jesus and they see what they want to see. Because to see the real Jesus, to see who he is, requires following him, and that's not so comfortable for us. We don't follow him sometimes because we're ashamed. We don't follow him sometimes because we don't want to serve. And we don't follow him sometimes because we covet that worldly status and that worldly notion of success. But Jesus says, come to me, follow me, take up your cross, let me show you a better way. Are you ready to follow Jesus this morning? Are you ready to give those things up, that worldly status? If so, won't you come forward and be baptized into his name?